Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, blessed souls, In the Field the King Will Be by Blessed Brother Isaac Picton from his classic album Songs for a Brother Volume 1, which is I am so happy to play after several weeks where we did not play any instrumental music. Greetings and blessings and greetings, blessed souls, and just to remind everyone, the only one you can find around the world is our blessed creator, the Ein Sof Baruch Hu, the infinite one, may be blessed. Welcome now to Soul Class number 292, In Search of Ancient Authentic Torah. This is the 70th class or tutorial or program, whatever you want to call it. And while we wait for one of our co-hosts to call in, hopefully it'll be Dennis Ryan, we also might be joined by Ron Williams and perhaps Cartrell Gore, the president of the Booker T. Washington Business League, an organization dedicated to the empowerment of human beings living in the New York City area and hopefully in the greater environs in the near future. Blessed souls, welcome back as we continue to explore the book of Genesis. In chapter 3, verse 16, quote, and again this is all recorded by the mighty Levite prophet Moshe Moses, where it is written, quote, to the woman he said, quote, I shall increase your sorrow and your pregnancy. In pain you shall bear children, and to your husband will be your desire, and he will rule over you. Wow. I am sure this verse is the subject of scorn of many women, and even men, perceiving this verse above as the source of oppressing the female gender, or even justifying the suffering and blaming of all female descendants of original woman, Eve, whose name from Lashon HaKodesh, the Holy Tongue, is Chava. Or is there an instruction here for symbiotic relations between male and female, husband and wife, and on any elevated consciousness level between understanding and wisdom, Bina and Chochmah? As well, we hope the dialogue on teachings from Rambam, Chabad Hasidus, Israelite prophetic axioms, the Book of Daniel, and whatever will transpire when discussions take place during a live broadcast on Blessed Blog Talk Radio. So please join us as you are right now, or you can also at your future convenience. If you're not listening to us live, hear the archived version, or you can call in right now if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, and you want to make the class a little more organic. Meanwhile, may we all be blessed and anointed by the Ein Sof Baruch Hu, the Infinite Creator, blessed be He, to realize and internalize when we will all see with our fleshly eyes the full revelation of Mashiach Messiah, and spiritual sensitivity shall guide us to be more tuned into Torah, divine instruction, with all of its practical implications, as well as empower us to use matters of this world for true sustainable good. I'm joined now by our co-host, Torah Rambam elucidator and student of Rambam, Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Maimonides, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Don. You can call me any name you want.
Well, I won't forget to call you before it's too late to call you for dinner.
I even answered to, hey, you, okay?
That's right. Now, it's been raining here in Boiler Room Brooklyn since last night and this morning, and I think Dennis's attempts to get on the show have emulated the rain. He's been coming and dropping out, dropping in and dropping out. I guess, I don't know what's going on with the phone connection. Hopefully it'll be a stable connection, Dennis, for the rest of the show. And before we continue, bless those, I just want to mention this as a caveat that anything Dennis or I or anyone else who might call in, we are expressing solely our opinions, and for the sake of avoiding wasting our time to getting into debate, rather we are both, in particularly Dennis and myself, offering our personal opinions. We are not representing any organizations. We are trying to share our faith, and hopefully there's some knowledge embedded in our faith and some faith embedded in our knowledge to assist you, blessed soul, to want to explore deeper into your relationship between the Almighty Creator and how to deepen your relationships in hopefully a positive, sustainable way with other human beings and the rest of the creation here on this blessed planet Earth. Dennis, any opening thoughts before I want to give some public praise to the Creator for some good things that happened to my family recently?
Well, yes, I'd like to mention one thing that you quoted in the Genesis verse there. There's pain involved in creation. When humans, females, give birth, it's not an easy thing. Mm-hmm. To me, it's a pain, but it's a pain of love because you're involved in creation. You're not just doing this as though it's a bad meal you just ate. And there's a gestation period for humans that takes 9 months. Mm-hmm. So it shouldn't be a shock. Yet on TV in the last couple of days, I've heard some women talking about women's needs, women's cares, and other things like that. I don't deny that at all. But you can't say that giving birth is a shock. If you've been carrying at least one baby for 9 months, you should know it has to come out. And that creation has to come out into the world, and sometimes it's not an easy thing. You cannot mm-hmm. press a button and all of a sudden create another human. It's a labor of love. It is not a shock. So there is some pain involved in the world, and women have to endure it, men don't. We just sit by and watch the world go by. However, a woman in labor for several days is excruciating, but she knows the reward that God has given her, and that is a positive thought.
True. Thank you, Dennis, for bringing that, and hopefully you'll embellish that and amplify that perspective as we get to the last portion of the show when we'll be discussing that verse. Blessed souls, I'd like to share with you something plucking generously from a weekly newsletter that comes out called Geula, G-E-U-L-A-H, which is News and Views on the Redemption. And they cited in this past publication concerning a breakthrough to trying to help blind people see. And it was basically an endeavor that was carried out by scientists at Hebrew University, which as far as I recall is located on Mount Scopus in Jerusalem. And they seem to have found a way to help blind people see through a device that converts images into sound waves. and with a certain amount of training, people who have been born with blindness can learn to actually recognize faces, describe objects, identify letters and words, and even make fast and accurate movements towards a target. This process of converting sensory information from one system within the brain to another system of the brain is called, quote, sensory substitution, end of quote. It has long been believed that someone who is blind from birth, and when the visual cortex receives no stimulation, that it will never develop properly. However, researchers were surprised to discover that blind people who learn to, quote unquote, see, as they are described, as they described it above, as I read above, with their ears, were actually processing the information in their visual cortex. The adult brain developed in response to stimulation. Now, Dr. Amir Amidi, who was involved in the study, who actually directed the study, said the following: the adult brain is much more flexible than we previously believed. These findings give hope for restoring sight for people who have been blind for prolonged periods through futuristic interventions like retinal transplant or direct stimulation that bypasses the eyes altogether. Now, last week, blessed souls, we had a holiday, which was the recollection and the commemoration and the celebration of the giving, what the world knows to be as the Ten Commandments, but we of Israel call the Torah, the instruction that was given by the Most High. And there were verses in the Torah which you can see for yourself. You can go to chapter 19 in the book of Exodus and go and read it through chapter 20 in the book of Exodus, where it says, quote, and all the people saw the voices and the torches and the sound of the shofar. Really, you should read this. Saw the voices and they saw the thunder and the sound of the shofar and the smoking mountain. So Rashi, in his commentary, and again, he is considered to be the primary elucidator of the written Torah for the last around 1,000 years, where commenting on it, where it said all the people saw, indicate that the blind were healed and were able to see. But what does it mean to say they saw the voices and the torches, really the thunder, and the sound of the shofar? How do you see sound? And Rashi says they saw what is usually heard. Now, in the Hasidic teachings, there is an understanding in our usual state of existence. We see the physical, while the spiritual is something that we only hear about. It is abstract, removed from our everyday experience. Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, the renowned defender of Israel, who was able to reveal that we should even love those who seem to be some of the more lower members of our people, and it's something which can provide universal instruction for all peoples to reach out to those who are in unfortunate situations or have gone in, so to speak, a bad way. He was accustomed to say, and again, this is not denying what took place at Mount Sinai, but to reason out, to try to learn out a merit upon people who are, so to speak, walking in this world blindly, not just literally, but figuratively, spiritually, that he was known to say that if the Most High had played the Torah in the streets and the temptations of the world in a book, no one would ever sin. But when the Torah was given, this was reversed. The Torah was given into the book and temptations are in the street. So with this being said, this was a reverse, as well as there was a reversal which transpired with that which was normally heard was seen, and that which was normally seen was heard. The veil was lifted, and the people at that time were able to directly see and experience godliness. Now, the point that this article, and what I'd like to embellish, and hopefully Dennis will share his perceptions on this, is that we take for granted the physical, and sometimes we become blind to the spiritual, that there is something beyond what we are living within in this physical world. But however, we do have the ability to conceptualize matters which have not been seen physically by anyone, but yet our conceptualization of certain experiences in our lives, recalling the past, And now they've shown that studies that, like, for instance, when a person writes or thinks about an experience in their earlier part of their lifetime, that they can actually feel a sense of rejuvenation. And no one's going to suggest that if I think about an experience I had when I was 15, my body will morph back into my body as it was when I was 15. No, but the point is that if I relive the experience, although I physically cannot do that, I see it within my mind, if I replay those positive experiences when I was 15, and I have a renewal of that experience, even though it's not a physical manifestation, you know, in my immediate environment, or if I were to describe it to any of you out there in the radio world or the world of cyberspace. So with that being said, we'll conclude, then we'll turn to Dennis for his viewpoint, is that this process of completion, of making the connection between spiritual and physical and spiritual, when all the blind, whether it be figuratively or literally, will be healed, we will no longer be blind to the spiritual radiance that lies just beyond what we consider to be our physical vision. What we are expecting is not a fantasy world, but that we will see that part of our daily reality is to see that there is a greater picture constantly before our eyes, whether physical or spiritual, and it's a matter of how to react to it in order to take positive action to make it a better world. Dennis, I said a lot, so I expect you to either make a short or an elongated statement, which I'm sure will be spiritually very dense in the most positive sense.
Well, our bodies are wonders, not wonders of the human world. It's a wonder of God's world. We humans are still trying to figure out what the body does. We've managed to isolate different pieces here and there. Mm-hmm. To give you an example, I suffer from what we call drop foot, and that is that my left leg drags. But someone invented a little gadget that coincides with the electrical nerves, sends impulse that I wear around my, just below my knee, so the leg picks up and points in the correct direction when I walk, when I turn it on, because it's pulsating. So what it's doing, it's replicating what the nerves should be doing in the leg. Mm-hmm. Now, this is just the leg. We have artificial hands being created all over the place. We have people who are being not experimented on, but being tested for years, that the brain waves are transferred onto a TV screen or a CRT terminal. And we can actually get an idea of what's going on. We don't know how to control it. The human doesn't know how to control it, but we know it's there. So can you see without looking? Can you hear without hearing? We must remember that the mind is like a giant antenna. It absorbs everything in its environment. Mm-hmm. We haven't even scratched the surface for most of its uses, but we're still trying and trying. So this must give people a sense that we're not strictly 100% human. There's parts of us that were put together for purposes higher than the human level. So the supernatural does mix with the human, and that's what happens in the mind. So there's hope. We're experimenting. We're finding out more things every day. And like I said before, science is trying to figure out what God put together.
True. Dennis, I'd like to call to your attention, other blessed souls listening out there, that we have the honor and privilege of introducing now President of the Booker T. Washington Business League, Karchel Gore. Karchel, thank you for calling in this morning.
Toda rabba, Booker T. Marine, Washington Chem.
Thank you very much, Karchel. Karchel was wishing a good morning and wishing us all well. And Karchel, just to call to your attention, we have Dennis Ryan on the line. And,
hi there. I just want to say that on Monday, June the 10th, I'll be with Rabbi Yaakov Coleman at a Noahide meeting at 777 United Nations Plaza, 6 p.m.
Beautiful,
and,
beautiful. Will there be a topic of discussion?
Well, we're talking about how the one creator is the creator of us all, of all humanity. And I might be speaking. I asked to speak about the psychology of the suicide bomber. which is what I presented to my unit when I retired, in my retirement ceremony, because I've done research on that topic. And it hasn't been approved yet. They're talking about it, but it hasn't been approved yet. But they'll be talking about a few things. And that might be my specific input.
Well, I hope that, and I'll ask you to repeat that event hopefully at the end of the show, Cartrell, or the program
today.
I
don't think I'll be on that long, but... but
okay.
Well, before
you sign off, we'll repeat that announcement, okay?
Great.
What I'd like to do, John, before we proceed, is to publicly thank the creator of all creation for some good news that happened with my parents. Last January, or late December, my father went in for some work on his... I believe it was his left big toe. And at that time, his heart actually stopped for several intermittent periods for 3 seconds. And the doctor actually had to apply an external pacemaker and start a whole period of evaluations of my father. I thought he would need a long-term pacemaker. And he's been hooked up to a device where he calls up once a month, I believe, to Valley Hospital, which is in Ridgewood, New Jersey, to see how his heart's doing. Well, Baruch Hashem, thank God, his heart is not only doing well, that they determined that what was the cause of that procedure to widen out the veins in his lower foot leading up into his big toe had actually, the stress from that procedure actually caused his heart to stop for those 3 second intervals, which really was a very scary experience for the doctor who was the vascular surgeon was involved. However, the good news I want to share with you is this past Friday, in speaking with my father, that since that time when his toe was very inflamed and very reddish looking, like bloody red where the toenail would be and in the area surrounding the toe, that the swelling has gone down, and now for the first time since late last week, he now does not wear a shoe or a sneaker where the top was cut off to allow his foot to have the ability to not feel encumbered by the shoe that's surrounding it. So right now my father's walking now around in regular shoes or regular sneakers, which is a great thing. And also my mother, who went through a very horrific time last summer. We even thought that, heaven forbid, we almost lost her last summer because of the excruciating pain in her back, is now engaging positively in physical therapy to increase the area around the problem where she has severe back pain. And when she said to me she's feeling a little better, she agreed with me when I said, "Mom, I'm glad you're telling me you're feeling a little better than you're feeling a little bit worse." So I just want to thank the Most High. I know a lot of people have been praying for the improvement of the strength of my parents, physically and spiritually, and I just want to say thank you, God, for allowing me to have this moment in time on May 19th, 2013, or the 10th of Sivan, 5,773 years since original man and woman, to say thank you for the continual, incremental levels of healing that both my parents, who are not spring chickens, because I'm not a spring chicken, they're older chickens, and I'm a younger chicken, a younger chick, as you might say. So I just want to express my thanks to the Creator for being able to share that good news with everyone out there. And again, thank you for your prayers and well wishes for myself and my family. Dennis, what would you like to share with our Blessed Soul listenership out there according to the teachings of Rambam?
Well, we're going to go back to the Guide for the Perplexed, page 390.
Okay.
These are the words of the Rambam. The philosophers have already explained how the bodily forces of man in his youth prevent the development of moral principles. In a greater measure, this is the case as regards the purity of thought which man attains through the perfection of those ideas that lead him to an intense love of God. Man can by no means attain this so long as his bodily humors are hot. The more the forces of his body are weakened, the fire of passion is quenched. In the same measure does man's intellect increase in strength and light. His knowledge becomes purer, and he is happy with his knowledge. When this perfect man is stricken in age and is near death, his knowledge mightily increases. His joy in that knowledge grows greater, and his love for the object of his knowledge more intense. And it is in this great delight that the soul separates from the body. To this state, our sages referred. When in reference to the death of Moses, Aaron and Miriam. They said that the death was in these three cases nothing but a kiss. They say thus, we learn from the words, quote, and Moses the servant of the Lord died there in the land of Moab by the mouth of the Lord, unquote, Deuteronomy 32:5. That his death was a kiss. The same expression is used of Aaron. And Aaron the priest went up to the mount, into Mount Or, by the mouth of the Lord, and died there. Numbers 33:38. Our sages said that the same was the case with Miriam, but the phrase "by the mouth of the Lord" is not employed because it was not considered appropriate to use these words in the description of her death, as she was a female. The meaning of this saying is that these three died in the midst of pleasure derived from the knowledge of God and their great love for him. When our sages figuratively call the knowledge of God united with intense love for him a kiss, they follow the well-known poetical dictation, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, Psalms 2:2. This kind of death, which is in truth is deliverance from death, has been ascribed by our sages to none but to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. The other prophets and pious men are beneath that degree, but their knowledge of God is strengthened when death approaches. Of them, Scripture says, quote, thy righteous shall go before thee, the glory of the Lord shall be thy reward. That's Isaiah 55 to 8. The intellect of these men remains constantly in the same condition, since the obstacle is removed that at all times has intervened between the intellect and the object of the action. It continues forever in that great delight, which is not like bodily pleasure. We have explained this in our work, as others have explained before us. To understand this chapter, endeavor with all your might to spend more and more time in communion with God or in the attempt to approach him, and to reduce the hours which you spend in other occupations, and during which you are not striving to come nearer unto him.
Well, Dennis, you know, I felt you just served up a full course meal of empowerment for any person who was blessed enough to hear those words of Rambam. I feel no need. I don't think I'm capable of elucidating that wisdom. Quatra, any comments on what Dennis just read?
Not really. Okay. Inspiring, so I have no comment.
Okay. So I'd like to now go and I would like to embellish and sort of continue, because he talked about matters which are related to what we're going to talk about now. According to a teaching of Rambam, and I'm plucking from the teachings of Maimonides, Jacob S. Minchan. Excuse me one second, gentlemen, and bless us, my son is standing next to me, but he wants to tell me something. Well, I'm just going to put myself on hold. If you can just bear with me 1 second, we'll find out what he wants. Yeah. Well, we're back online, no problem, Yosef. And that was my son asking me where was my daughter's recharge electric cord to her computer. So now we're going to turn to this, the teachings of my mom, Jacob Minkin, and again, we'll hopefully this will embellish what Dennis just spoke about. It reads like this, as follows. Prophet and wise men alike were positive in their affirmation of the resurrection of the dead. In the prophet Isaiah, we read, quote, your dead shall live, my dead body shall arise, awake, and you shall sing, those of you that dwell in the dust. For your dew is the dew of light, and the earth shall bring to light the shades. End of quote. Now, Rabbi Elazar HaKapar, who lived a long time before the Rambam, according to this teaching of Rambam, was quite ambiguous in his declaration in the Book of Ethics, chapter 4, verse 22, which is actually universal teachings in Hasidic or pious behavior. For those of us, anyone who wants to learn more, understand what is the Hasidic way of life, one can turn to the book of the ethics of our fathers or the fathers. Or is following: those that are born are destined to die, and the dead to be brought to life again. However, Maimonides, without specifically expressing himself on the form resurrection was to take, asserted generally that not the wicked but the righteous only would be resurrected. Some years later, he was actually challenged for his viewpoint by someone by the name of Samuel Bar Ali, a scholar I never heard of, I'm sorry. I can't have nothing really to say about him, but it did prompt Maimonides to write a discourse called Maimar al Tachiyat HaMetim, or Maimar al Tachiyat HaMesim, the discourse on the resurrection of the dead, referred to elsewhere, in which he wrote, quote, "The resurrection of the dead is a primary doctrine of the law of Moses, peace unto him, and he who does not believe in it is without faith and cannot claim no affiliation with the Jewish faith, but is the reward of the righteous only, for how shall the evildoers live after death, seeing as is maintained by the sages that they are dead even in life," end of quote. Unlike resurrection, which appeared to Maimonides as being incapable of philosophical proof, he treated with special relish the subject of immortality, which he maintained expresses the real teaching of the Judaic spirituality on life after death. But it was an intellectual immortality that Maimonides taught, a life of disembodied spirits whose delights are spiritual, whose pleasures are unworldly, whose highest satisfaction is derived from the ability to contemplate and comprehend God. He dismissed as allegorical the exquisite stories of the rabbis of the Talmud and of the material delights awaiting, that the righteous in heaven, and instead quoted fondly Rav's statement, quote, "There is neither eating nor drinking nor any sensual desire nor strife in the world to come, but the righteous with their crowns upon their heads sit around the table of God, delighting in the splendor of the divine presence, which is known as the Shekhinah." In our last paragraph, when the exalted state which is set up for the pious after death, their blissful enjoyment of God's majesty is reached, there are no earthly joys or pleasure of the senses which can compare with it. Man or woman living in the material world with all of his or her physical faculties adjusted only to what he or she can see, feel, and experience, can as little comprehend the delights of the soul after it has disrobed itself of its earthly trappings as the blind can distinguish color, or the ear of the deaf to sound can appreciate a musical melody. As Isaiah is quoted again, no eye has seen it, O Creator, besides you, said Isaiah. This one infers from Maimonides concerning immortality is a recurring message of the prophets and the sages of Israel, which in the course of time, due to the adverse circumstances in which the Jewish people lived, became grossly materialized, its meaning changed, and its truth distorted. So what happened was, is that, well, first of all, I want to be very careful in asserting that we are not here, and I speak of myself personally, to judge who is the righteous and who is the wicked. The actions of those, or all of us, will be the testimony as to what our true intent was in this world, and it is not for me to even attempt to point fingers at who is wicked and who is righteous. I mean, I will identify those righteous teachers that I've experienced being face-to-face to them, or people who have a tradition that are righteous in our history. And when people are identified as wicked or evil in the Torah, that is based on a prophetic perception and consciousness, and even the oral Torah tradition. But in terms of, I don't feel it is my role to point the finger directly at any one person and say that this person is such and such and won't merit, you know, life after the current stage of existence we have, which is called as death, which is part of the continuum of life, but rather that this is to present ideas for those who are unfamiliar with them. What is the Judaic perception on life? What is the Judaic perception of what is spirituality? And what is the Judaic perception of how do we interface with the concepts of immortality or resurrection of the dead? Dennis, any take on these matters?
Yes, it's called humility. Rambam, who was, I would consider, a type of a genius, even with his intellect, did not go over the line, because judgment is reserved for the Lord. Mm-hmm. And no human can come and approach that line. And that's why we use the words very carefully. That's why you make the statement before you begin the program that the views expressed on this program are personal views of people. We're not promoting different groups or saying we are the truth, we are perfect, we are giving you 100%. No, those phrases don't have any meaning. Humans are not perfect. So, when you also mentioned about what happens when we die or the world ends or anything like that, I like to go back to the words of Jesus of Nazareth, where he once said, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, render unto God what is God's." Implied there is that everything that God has given, he can take back. It is his to do whatever he wants. We don't even understand how he's going to do it, when is he going to do it, etc. But we believe in him and we have faith because there is no better words and understanding of other than God as we can conceive him today. So mm-hmm. therefore, we don't have substitutions. If you do start using substitutions, you are taking the wrong turn somewhere. So let me end it at that before I go on and on.
Cartrell, any take on the matter of, I mean, I know that you did not originally start out as an observant son of Noah, in adhering to the seven Noahide commandments. The idea of resurrection and life after death, or the return of life after one has experienced physical death in this world, how do you recall how you were taught that as, when you were growing up or in your young adulthood?
Yes. I was taught as a Christian that after the physical death, there is a judgment. And only infants who have lived without sin can pass that judgment unless their sins are forgiven. And for a Christian, a sin is forgiven by belief in Jesus. Now, I was also taught that Jews who sacrificed the Passover lamb and fulfilled their commandments were forgiven, but only until the time of the crucifixion. After the crucifixion, only people who became, basically who became Christians, could have their sins forgiven. Now, there is some debate based on the book of Revelation that 144 Jewish people have their sins forgiven, but only that number. That's kind of, it's mentioned in some parts of Christianity. It's not mentioned throughout Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But because the book of Revelation is probably the least read book of the New Testament, but it's popular in some churches.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, now, in 2005, I decided I was no longer going to be a Christian. And I chose the laws of Noah as the way I go. Now, the laws of Noah are very similar to the Ten Commandments. They're very similar, which
that's
I learned in my young days. They don't talk about animal cruelty. They don't talk about animal cruelty. Maintaining justice, I think, is basically implied in all the Ten Commandments, I would think. It's not expressed, but it's basically implied.
If I can interject for one moment, there are, in fact, laws concerning animal cruelty as it applies to seven Noahide laws, because someone of the nations is not allowed to eat the limb of an animal while it's still alive. And that also is involved with not to remove the limb of the animal even before one can eat it, but rather the animal should be totally physically dead to remove the limb of an animal that's still partially alive is considered to be an act of cruelty. And there are other sub-laws that go into that, but I'm not going to bring that up now. That's something that people can learn on their own. If they can go to various websites. They can even contact Rabbi Cohen, who you'll be hopefully be accompanying to the United Nations in a couple weeks.
Don?
Yeah, yes, Dennis.
We have a lot of people who are good people. They don't have bad motives, but they sometimes express their opinions even though they don't know enough about the subject.
Mm-hmm.
But they are good people. That doesn't mean that everything comes out of their mouth is good. So when mm-hmm. you're a kid and you're growing up, a lot of these people did their best to help your understanding through their understanding. If they didn't have a good understanding, they left you with something better than you should have had.
Mm.
I mean, less than you should have had, excuse me. But we have good-minded people, but they don't always come out with good instructions.
True. And, you know, again, sometimes that we do evidence, we have seen that people are very well-meaning, but for whatever reason, they've been traumatized by certain events in their lives that it causes them to have a certain bent to even take a good message and distort it, even though they have no intention of doing so, but because the way they perceive things, or they might be, for instance, experiencing a post-traumatic stress syndrome, or they could be, unfortunately, prey to mental illness. Their take on things, and I mean, I even see in my
Don, well, I'm not talking about mentally disturbed people. I'm talking about normal people. We have a lot of normal people walking around giving out ideas that they're personal ideas, but they're pushing it as though you must believe it.
Right.
No, you consider it, you take it as a suggestion.
I hear you. Cool. I just want to mention, when we talk about, I just want to point out that in my field, in the mental health field, is that we look at people not according to their diagnosis, that a person with a diagnosis, say bipolar or schizophrenic or schizoaffective or ADD, that we don't consider that to be their persona as much as, say, for instance, is a person's persona colored because they have diabetes type 1 or diabetes type 2 or have morbid obesity or have, I don't know, heaven forbid, and I say about those other conditions as well, or a heart condition. It's just that somehow a person can color things from some aspect of their personality, of their human makeup, that can distort things, even though it's not their intent. It's just they those people who can overcome it, they become actually the spokespeople, the spokesmen and the spokeswomen for, say, like the mental health movement, where people who have been had, for instance, who have been hospitalized so many times. I don't mean to get tangential, but I think it's a point worth sharing. For instance, there's a Dr. Pat Deegan who had so many rapid hospitalizations in her late teens that actually she found eventually, because of after release of one of her hospitalizations, she went back home. That actually empowered her to eventually be what she is now, one of the leaders in mental health care for people with mental illness. And no one is going to say she's distorting it because she's worked so hard and she's overcompensated. So well-meaning people can get out the message properly, and sometimes well-meaning people, regardless what their makeup is physically, spiritually, and mentally, they can distort it because they're not trying to, they're not conscious of the fact they have to, you know, the Rambam talks about being in the middle path, not to be an extremist in either which way. And most of us, I think, have a struggle to stay in the middle path. Being in the middle path of life, concerning one's eating and drinking and other habits, is probably the most sure-fired way to project a message, regardless on the manner of knowledge one has, but the fact that one is going that middle balance path to try to present information, which hopefully will be received, if that's their intention, by the most amount of people possible.
Similar to trying to create a jury in our justice system. We try to get people who have good motives, clean minds, but all humans are the summation of everything they have experienced.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you cannot pick and choose what you're going to use in your mind. You may try to, but it's there. You can't avoid it. There's no eraser for your memory. It's there. We just hope that people will use their best judgment, not take away all the prejudice or the biases they've seen in their lifetime, which still exists probably today. We ask them just to think of the positive good things and do your best.
True. Dennis and Cartrell, I'd like to bring on as well our other co-host, and I'm very happy that he's going to take some of his valuable time to be with us. Ron Williams, good morning, Ron. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, good morning, Don, Dennis and Cartrell.
Morning, Ron.
Okay. Better late than never, I think that's the saying.
Okay. Ron, rather than getting your, I don't know how much you've been listening in, but I'm going to now segue to some music, which might be a little bit controversial for some people to hear this. There was a group in the, I don't know if they were in the late 60s, but they certainly were in the 1970s, a group called Redbone, and the group was constituted of Native American Indians. Now, they actually made a song, which I hope to play now, hopefully the sound quality is decent, called Wounded Knee, which was actually a big hit in Europe, and I think in particularly in England. However, the song was banned from radio stations in the United States of America. Now, the reason why I want to play this song, Blessed Souls, is that they bring up a salient point that, according to the spirit, they don't say this, but I'm just bringing it out here, that in the spirit and the fulfillment of the seven anointed commandments, when there is conflict between nation and nation, as there were for several hundred years between the Europeans that came here and with the Native American people, who are the indigenous people of the North Americas, that many treaties were made, and unfortunately many treaties were broken by the United States government to the detriment of the continuing empowerment and flourishment of the American Indian people. Now, I know there are people who say, well, you know, winner takes all and winner calls the shots, but according to Torah viewpoints, but according to the spirit of the seven high commandments, that truthfulness should be a guiding light in negotiations between nation and nation, especially when there's been conflict, and there was a lot of conflict, a lot of dead on both sides, mostly on the side of the Native American Indians, who lost some of them have quoted as much as 40, 50 million over 300-year plus history from the time that the settlers came in, the time of Plymouth Rock. Before I do want to play the song, I do want to send out a special shout out to Thomas Eason of Sherwood, Arkansas. And thank you, Thomas, for giving some positive typing feedback on our humble efforts this morning. Without further ado, we're going to play now Redbone, Wounded Knee. I hope everyone will hear the song clearly. And if you don't hear it clearly on the live version of our show or program or tutorial, whatever you want to call it, you can hear it probably with better quality on the archive version. This is 3 minutes and 15 seconds by Redbone, Wounded Knee. Hold on, please, and I hope everyone will enjoy this song.
We were all wounded. At Wounded Knee, you and me, we were all wounded. At Wounded Knee, you and me, in the name of Memphis Destiny, you and me, you and me. We were all
Souls, that was Wounded Knee by Redbone. Now, for some people, that might have been a very energetic, creative song. For others, it might rub them the wrong way. But the lyric that caught my attention, I hope we'll break off into a little brief discussion here, is that the singer of the song talked about the idea of manifest destiny. Now, I am not someone who is well-learned in that piece. I remember learning it briefly when I was in high school, but from the American Indian perspective, and maybe we'll go around the table, that this was a doctrine that was formulated in Europe, which was justifying the slaughter or the disempowerment of the Native American peoples in America, and it was forwarding the idea that, so to speak, the course of the human history was now in a deterministic mold where the Europeans should dominate wherever they should go in the name of their faith, which was, I believe, something which is emanating ultimately from the Vatican several hundred years ago. Now, we do know that determinism as a philosophy held sway for several hundred years, but in the light of quantum physics has sort of been subjugated to the virtual placing of butter in the skillet pan of truth, and has basically been fried up or melted away or cooked up, and basically now can be considered another ingredient of human consciousness, which we can talk about, but it really holds no sway, especially in the light of prophetic destiny, which has been prophecies by the on the half of experienced by Israelites and Noahites going back to original man and woman. So Dennis, we'll start with you. The idea of manifest destiny, are we still as a human culture caught up in it? Or do you see signs that that people are breaking through to see that although there are things which have been, so to speak, set in prophetic stone is not here to turn us into a little stoned out, you know, illusionary, euphoric human beings with like highfalutin ideas, which Rambam was certainly against, when really practical meat and potatoes, improvement of the sustainability of the earth.
Well, humans are fickle people. Well, depending on how the wind blows, they can change their mind. So this comes in and out of history over a long period of time. The only thing I can say is my personal philosophy, and that is that when an injustice occurs, all of human justice takes a hit. When a person dies unnecessarily, the world of humans takes a hit.
True. Cottrell, when you were growing up and you were starting to get your scholastic ideals actualized, I remember you mentioned that you went through some trials and tribulations education. When you were struggling in your educational experiences, did you ever foresee that you would eventually become a man of many letters and scholastic achievements? Could you see that?
I was just taking things one at a time, one step at a time, basically. Mm-hmm. So I was just considering getting things just one step at a time.
As simple as that.
Yeah. And the longest journey starts with a single step of my adding credit courses and credits. I earned my first degree, and then I earned my second two after that. And that was great because the Department of Education, we get paid for the education we amass, not the education that we apply. So that was good.
Right. But let me ask you a question. What helped you break out of when you were in that period of perhaps scholastic you were not fully scholastically oriented, or you were not experiencing success. You would have liked to have achieved, but you weren't accomplishing it. What kept you going to break out of the mold? Aside from one step, was it something that you read, a movie you saw, a relative or a parent that encouraged you? What helped you, so to speak, break out of that deterministic mold? If you weren't successful, you never would be successful in your scholastic endeavors and eventually your ability to generate a nice living.
Well, I did have friends and relatives that inspired me, and mm-hmm. I just had to sit down, buckle down, and get the job done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Ron, are we trapped into the future of the history as predicated or provided for us, I should say, by the Most High, or do we have free choice to accessing the very teachings which tell us where our eternity is going if we choose to do good, or the opposite of choosing to do good?
Okay, I'll go back into the past. When I was growing up as a child, my mother always said, the way you make your bed, that's how you lie in it. And then I'll zoom back to the present, where reading in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses said to the people before entering the land of Israel, choose good, choose life, instilling in them before entering into the land of Israel, where their existence will become more of a normal existence as opposed to their kind of miraculous existence through the desert, instilling in them the option that is available to make choices. So I don't really think that we're our fate is determined in any possible way. I think that is designed by our actions and our intentions.
Beautiful. That being said... Yeah, yes, Dennis.
What happens is God knows everything. Mm-hmm. We have a free will. Use it wisely.
I agree. Okay. That being said, Ed Cartron, we'd like to add anything else, or can we move on? What's up to you?
All right, I'm going to have to move along pretty soon, but I just want to remind the people that I'll be with Rabbi Jacob Cohn, 6 p.m. Monday, June 10th at 777 Yuman Plaza. We'll be discussing a variety of topics. My most expertise topic is a suicide bomber, and hope to see some people there.
Okay. Carjo, before you sign off, would you be interested in sharing your Booker T. Washington business telephone if people want to reach out to talk about that matter with you, or any other matter to help empower individuals?
Okay. My number is 718-670-3717.
Okay. Thank you, Cartrell, for joining us this morning, and may you have a blessed week. And hopefully next week we hope to do a show. Maybe you can come in again and remind the people listening in, and then hopefully after that event you can report back to us how it went.
Sounds good.
Okay, take care.
Don?
Take care, Cartrell.
Yes, Dennis.
God has a telephone number. It's in your head. Hopefully it's on speed dial.
Very good.
And
take
I'd like
care.
To emphasize, I'd like them. It's a wireless connection. You don't have to sign a contract with the Almighty Creator. You just dial them up, and you get them. With that being said, gentlemen, bless those tuned in today's program. I'd like to share with you very quickly and the sources for these six commandments, which are all positive. And why, and a brief discussion with Dennis and Ron and Dennis about the aspect of faith and why faith is not mentioned here in Rambam. Maimonides, in enumeration of the first six positive commandments or mitzvahs of the Torah. The first of the positive commandments is the mitzvah to know that there is a God, as it says in Exodus 20, verse 2, quote, and you shall love God your Lord, end of quote. Then in Deuteronomy chapter 6, 4, Rambam states, to unify him, as it says in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, God is our Lord, God is one. The third positive commandment Rambam lists is, as listed in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5, is to love him, as it states in the verse, quote, and you shall love God your Lord, end of quote. The fourth commandment that we're listing here in the positive is to fear the Almighty Creator, as it's written in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 13, states, fear God your Lord. Then the fifth positive commandment, as according to Rambam Maimonides, is to pray. As it says in Exodus 23, verse 25, quote, and you shall serve God your Lord, and this is the service of prayer, according to Rambam, that automatic dial-up, as Ron, as Dennis was alluding to just a moment ago. And find the sixth positive commandment is to cling to him, as it says in Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 2, states, quote, and you shall cling to him, end of quote. Now, missing from these six commandments, and in fact, according to the Rambam's enumeration of the commandments, there is no commandment for human beings to have faith in the Creator. So, in this, I want to pluck a little bit from a Hasidic discourse about a back and forth discussion, and hopefully we'll get Dennis and Ron in this hopefully bountiful dialogue about why should we or we don't need at all the commandment of faith in the Creator. Now, there is a Torah sage that his name is Rabbi Yitzhak Arbanel, is that a commandment to have faith in God does not focus only on the fact of God's existence. If we were to take the perspective, there should be a commandment of faith in God, but there's no need for a commandment concerning connecting faith to God's existence, because we already know that the Creator exists, as will be explained. Instead, the commandment to have faith is to believe that his existence is most perfect. So he qualifies the idea of faith as it relates to the idea that the Most High's created existence is the most perfect. Now, the idea of perfection of Creator's existence is that there's a term called Mechoyev HaMetzius, meaning the fact that he is what obligates that there be the reality that all of us are experiencing in the physical world. And this whole idea of being the one who requires existence does not require faith, because there is already included in the knowledge that we already possess that there is God who grants life to the world, since he is identified in many places in the Torah as Creator. So it follows that since he is Creator, we as creation should recognize that he is the one that obligates existence, because we cannot for any moment consider, according to this perspective, that there can be existence outside of him. So on the one hand, there's no need to have faith, a commandment of faith in the Creator, a way of connecting to him, but rather this is taken as a given to empower us that once we understand that he is the one that obligates us to know him, he will take it as a granted that we believe in him because we want to know about the one who is creating our existence. I hope I wasn't being too convoluted, but I'll pass the ball first to Ron on this one. Ron, how do we engage people into this idea that faith is something which is readily at hand because we see the fact that we are in a creation that no human being could ever possibly promote the idea that we human beings created the world that we live in?
Before that, Dan, I just have to ask you a question for you to elucidate a little bit more on the fact of being commanded on an emotional response such as love and fear.
Mm-hmm. So what is the question?
The question is, how can we be commanded to love and fear when those are emotional responses?
Right. Very good question. And that's a question that I believe Rambam asks in his Foundations of the Laws of the Torah, the Foundations of the Torah, that how is one going to get love and fear of the Creator? Well, that love and fear of the Creator is generated by a meditation on his bonenus, contemplation upon looking into the creation and realizing someone larger than oneself. something larger than the very creation itself is behind all of this, in relation to looking at the entirety of creation as much as a person is capable at whatever stage of life he or she is in terms of their development and consciousness, they will feel puny. Now, puny not in the sense of having a low self-esteem, but puny of realizing that we have a, basically all of us in relation to the expanding universe of the Creator, we are like a molecule of consciousness. So if I am a molecule, I want to connect to not just only all the other molecules of consciousness, which help with other people, but I want to connect to the source of all the molecules, allegorically speaking, which is the Creator. And therefore, I want to love him for the fact that he's allowing me as one little human molecule to experience awareness of the fact that he is the source of all the molecules, human molecules in my life, or all the entire human molecular structure, or the entire universe. And the fear is, that who am I to trample upon his wisdom, or to reject it, or to trample upon other human molecules or human beings? Because molecules are really human beings in the source of the allegory here. So that's that. If we a healthy intellect must by and if we look into our own experiences, if we had a healthy intellectual endeavor concerning a certain subject matter, we gave forth healthy emotional manifestations. If I love to do, if I've intellectually come to the point where I understand it behooves me to do good, I love to do that good based on my intellectual reasoning. It's good for me to do good. That's the only. I'm sure there's other ways to explain it. I don't know if I don't think I've explained the definitive way, but that's just to get the just to pass the ball back into your. Into your realm, Ron.
So if that's the case, after this contemplation and realizing that there's a Creator who created this world and everything else, that basically is the foundation of that faith in which you asked me earlier.
Yeah, well, that's part of it. Yeah. Well, I mean, we're definitely here in the and we'll ask Dennis to chime in a second. That there has to be awareness. For instance. I was thinking about this, you know, before the show started, like a baby, a newborn baby, why does it instinctively know that the mother is its mother and the father is its father? Or is a child developing based on the closeness that it shares with its mother and father? Why does it have to be educated not to cringe when being approached by other people? And that cringing when approached by other people at a certain point where the child is still in the delicate stage of development causes the child to want to reach out to the mother or father. You know, no one taught the baby in the womb, and the only thing that the child is working on is the fact that it became conscious of the fact that some being, which we call human mother or human father, is hugging it and kissing it and feeding it and clothing it and giving it shelter, but it can't intellectually still elaborate on it. So it's just at that very delicate stage of life development. The child, I don't know where the child's faith is, but the child has some sort of awareness. As the child gets more intellectually aware and can verbalize what they're feeling, even if it's a goo-goo gaga or a mommy-daddy type of thing, there's going to be more developed sense of love and fear, loving to do what mommy and daddy want and fearing to disobey them. Dennis, I'm sure you have what to say on these matters.
Well, I'd like to reduce this discussion to a very simple, by the connecting of a very simple idea to a very complex one. Mm-hmm. And that is, there is no commandment for using common sense. There is no commandment warning us about stupidity. Yet, the Rambam's fervent hope, regardless of who you are, regardless of how much education you have, regardless of how much wealth you have, that you must think about God. When you think about God, things will come to you because God has given you the equipment to handle it. It's when you don't think about God, you get into a gray area. Now, I believe in what Rambam has tried to establish because I know it works. So if you get people to think about God, do you really think bad things are going to happen?
True. I think the only person who worries about bad things that will happen, and unfortunately has a low self-esteem about perhaps why or not, why is the attention being shifted from ego-centered consciousness to super-ego consciousness, which entails a person, so to speak, nullifying something of themselves, which for some people is a little bit threatening to the more altruistic way of making the world more sustainable. I mean, unfortunately, we have a lot of people that don't really believe in the total sustainability of the entire world for all the peoples. They believe it should be only for a certain percentage, a certain select percentage who perceive themselves as being the elite. And whether it be economically or even some people put them are spiritual elitists in a way that's sometimes even worse than the economic elitists or the cognitive elitists. You know, we're talking about the ivory tower type of personalities, which are, to me, are kind of dysfunction in the long haul of things, in the long stretch of the plan of the Creator. But this is what we're dealing with, but I adhere firmly to what you're saying, Dennis, is that Rambam's fervent desire and is the way he taught was that that people should be thinking constantly, as much as possible, given their circumstances, about the Almighty Creator. Dennis, Ron, you want to mention anything else before we go on to our next section? Ron? Well, Ron's on.
I just muted so not to have the external noise. No, please continue.
Okay. So that being said, we're going to pluck a little bit from axiomatic teachings about Israelite prophetic perspectives. And I'm going to be pulling from something by the Lubavitcher Rebbe. We're going to make this a little brief and a little brief. We'll pull a little bit from Daniel because I do want to extend our conversation about that verse in chapter 3, verse 16 in Genesis, that the prophet is privy to a divine emanation, which we call prophecy. And this divine emanation or prophecy is garbed and veiled to the point where a human mind can make some sort of meaningful interaction with it in order that they can share that with other people. The prophet's mind has to be suitably prepared and attuned to receive the emanation. In other words, for prophecy to manifest, as it has been classically written about in the Torah, is that there has to be a merging of minds between divine mindset, which certainly is tailored down in a diminished yet unchanging manner to reach the human mind, which must be elevated to receive some diminished revelation of the divine mind. And when these two criteria are met, there's a proportionality which is actualized, meaning the greater the intellectual abilities of the prophet and the higher that he or she can transcend their natural physical state, the less concealed is the divine emanation that he or she can in fact receive. So Rambam talks about this in chapter 7, law 2, in the laws of the foundation of the Torah concerning prophecy, where he writes, "The prophets are of various levels. Just as one sage is greater in wisdom than another, so too with regard to prophecy, one prophet is greater than another." Now, when there is one thing that all prophets share, with the exception of Moses, I believe, is that when the prophets of ancient prophets used to have a prophecy, experience it, as Rambam writes, continuing on in the Laws of Foundations of the Torah, teaching about prophecy, when the prophets would prophesize, their limbs would tremble, they would have a weakening of their body, and their senses are confused. But yet their minds would remain attuned to comprehend what they perceive. Now, this is probably an idea which is foreign to most people because, unfortunately, they learn about prophecy just by reading the written scripture. And unless they have someone to discuss this matter. And again, there are 10 or 11 different types of prophecy which are listed in, I believe, in Rambam's Mor Nevuchim, that there are some prophets who are relegated to prophesizing in a way of allegories and riddles. And then you had on the highest level, Moshe, who was given direct visions into the divine presence. And therefore, again, we're trying to understand that prophecy was not an easy process. It's a merging of minds. But when human mind, in order to receive some diminished revelation of divine mind, which again was unchanging even in a diminished state, just as when a parent says gugu gaga to a child, the parent's intellect, if they have a PhD or a master's or just have a lot of wisdom of life sense about them, they don't lose any of it. In fact, they become more flexible to be able to communicate their love for the child and their fear that nothing bad should happen for the child. So that's just something I want to share with you. I'm plucking from a book by Rabbi Chaim Miller in the Rambam's 13 Principles of Faith, focusing on principles 6 and 7 of prophecy. Dennis, any take on these matters?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You opened up the door, Don. No, not really. What happens is prophecies are good. We must understand that the people who gave the prophecies, at the time they were given the prophecies, their motives were positive, good, inspired by God himself. That doesn't mean that you're going to understand every prophecy. You may not understand it. You may have a hard time interpreting, but that doesn't mean you can throw it away or label it bad. You just haven't found the key to understand this. Rambam made this important subject called prophecy so that to help people understand, but he even brought up the enigmatic person called Balaam, who at one time was a bad guy, and another time he was a good guy, and he actually made some prophecies. So here Rambam is emphasizing that prophecies are good. Treat them as the hints of how to create a better life from God.
Yeah. Ron, your take on these matters? Ron?
Hello?
Yeah, Ron.
Hello?
Yes, Ron.
Yes, I'm here. I've always viewed prophecy as a way of the Creator communicating through the format of prophecy, through a prophet, someone who has attained a certain level of spiritual awareness. But as I've been reading a little bit on the subject, is that people used to prepare themselves, and they basically can actually, there was a schools of prophecies, of prophets. And I've also read where, besides Moses, all the other prophets were basically disconnected from their human faculties to a certain extent. They would just open their mouths and like a loudspeaker, the sound would emanate without them even forming the words. And I was blown away by that because I just imagine seeing someone prophesying in that fashion. Because I was always under the impression that they would just continue speaking, I guess, with just saying prophetic things.
Mm-hmm.
But the way in which I start understanding it is that they would basically be stricken by this sudden spiritual influx, and then they would open their mouths, and the words would just flow out of their mouth. So I was pretty, amazed by that. A little scary to begin with, though.
I hear you. Okay, with that being said, we're going to move on to a brief teaching from... the Rambam. I'm sorry about the Book of Daniel. And with that being said, basically, we're going to focus on the fact that when Nebuchadnezzar had, in fact, conquered Jerusalem, as we mentioned in previous programs, the king told Ashpenaz, We're going now to chapter 1, verse 3 in the book of Daniel. The book told Ashpenaz, the chief of his officers, to bring from the children of Israel, from the royal seed, and from the nobles. Now, one of the things that's brought out here is that to understand ancient culture, it's good to understand why, in fact, certain people or certain people of certain dispositions were appointed to in the service of the king. Now, in this case here, it's mentioned that Ashpenaz was the chief of his officers. Now, the word in the Hebrew is also related to the word of Sarsus, which means a eunuch, and that it was in the ancient cultures that eunuchs were actually used to administer in the courts of the king, because the king did not want the people serving them with very important duties, in Babylon, to be involved in any extracurricular activity, which could be even proper or improper sexuality. So therefore, that was one of the means that by which they would administer over their kingdoms, by hiring either servants, or it could have been that in some cases, and it's implied here that Nebuchadnezzar had chosen to employ, in probably compulsory fashion, eunuchs to select out from the children of Israel, from the royal seed, from the nobles, because he wanted to see their intellectual expansion for the purpose of being subdued to him. So while he destroyed the best of the most primary, I'm going to use a modern term, primary real estate of Israel, which was the area of the temple and Jerusalem, he certainly was not interested in destroying the people, which was sort of a unique thing by Nebuchadnezzar, because there have been despotic rulers in the history of the Jewish people who not only wanted to destroy our sovereignty, and many of them were successful up until this day, because we still don't have total sovereignty over the land of Israel, as will be prophetically, hopefully, evident soon in our days. Not for the sense of being oppressive, but being for the spiritual entity that we're supposed to be, to empower not only ourselves, but all the children of Noah, but also that the, again, going back to Nebuchadnezzar, is that his intent was to subdue Israel, not by just destroying the temple, but to using the creme de la creme, so to speak, of the stock of the royal house of the tribe of Judah to be in his service, to continue his rule. And that's just something that was part of ancient culture. I don't know if it's per se today in the mindset of modern rulers, whether it be Jewish people or taking the creme de la creme of other peoples. But it's just a perspective that perhaps many people are probably not considering when they review these teachings as written in the Tanakh and the book of Daniel. Ron or Dennis, any comments on these matters?
Yes. I hope you're not implying that eunuchs are holy people.
No,
I don't think
you
meant it that way, but it sort of came out in default logic, Don.
Well, I'll tell you, if a person was castrated against their will and was a loyal servant not to the king but the creator, because there are prophecies, I think, in Isaiah that talked about the eunuch says, "What I'm like a dried-out tree." The Most High says, if you will keep my commandments, you also have a portion. So we're not talking about a person who willingly would want to castrate himself, which I know is an absolute prohibition on the part of an Israelite. And Mom can maybe can comment if I don't think Noahides are allowed to castrate themselves, because we're supposed to be fruitful, multiply on the earth. The point is that people were pressed into service probably against their will, although there might have been someone enthusiastic about their services to the king. But the point is that the kings of antiquity demanded absolute loyalty, because if not, it was probably off with their heads.
Well, it's better that it was off with their heads than other parts, Don. But anyway, if it's against procreation, it has to be treated as being pro-God. Yeah. Because whether it happened, whether it was forced or not. But if it wasn't forced, then you can't say on a deliberate basis that that's a positive concept. Because it's interfering with the whole idea of procreation. At the same time, you must remember in history, I hate to bring this up, but eunuchs were used to take care of the harems for the chiefs and the emperors and the kings and all the other people who kept all these women on the side. Now, that was for procreation, but it used the wrong methodology, no?
I would say that was, again, they were forced into a service for basically the taivas, the desire, I would call unholy desires of those kings of antiquity. Ron, we'd like to chime in on this issue about, you know, trying to understand ancient culture. And it seems like a mindset which seems light years away from modern society, although, of course, there are people pressed into service against their will by certain, you know, government systems around the world.
No, it's not as far-fetched as it sounds if you think about it, because many times when they would send spies in to infiltrate the country, they would normally send, you know, beautiful women to tempt the men who held certain positions into divulging certain secrets. So these eunuchs normally, they know they really can't, you know, partake of these women, so they would be a little bit more, you know, resistant to their lures. But the eunuchs of... in the time of Mordecai and Esther, they were actually plotting against the king. So we see that even though the kings may do this to ensure a certain form of security, they themselves can plot against you. So there's no real safe, sure way of making, you know, this false security that we feel we can obtain by doing certain bizarre, you know, practices. So that's my take on it.
Okay. I'd like to go now into the last section. Actually, we were supposed to end at 12 o'clock, but gentlemen, if you hope you'll have the time, we can spill over into the top of the 12 o'clock hour, because I think this is a very, very important subject matter. You know, but so there are various verses in the Torah which I think have been so misunderstood and used not only to attack the nation of Israel in an insidious way to promote anti-Semitism and anti-Torah views, anti-God views, but also to oppress other people and put the blame on the Torah of Moses. And again, I think this is one of those verses that can be left up to such misinterpretation. And again, I'm not going to profess the ultimate viewpoint, and I want to dialogue around the cyberspace table with Ron and Dennis on this. But let's just read the verse first. Quote, "To the woman he said, I will greatly increase your anguish and your pregnancy. In anguish you shall give birth to children. To your husband shall be your passion, and he will dominate you." Now, I am sure this verse is looked upon and scorned upon, and might even, God forbid, even spat upon, literally, by feminists. And I want to say this, that I am a feminist. I'm also a masculinist. I believe in the empowerment of any human being. But I wanted the severity of the words of the Creator towards original woman should, I'm going to humbly suggest, should be understood in the context, who was original woman? I mean, she was not born of a human mother and a human father. And if one understands literally, and also with all the deeper understanding of the Torah, she was literally taken from the rib of her husband. You just have to go back a chapter or two into the book of Genesis. So man and woman originally came from one being, from one creator, out of one soil. And there is a reasoning, the reason why the Most High had given her a pretty harsh judgment, if we look back 5,773 years ago, is that in Eve's perception or misperception that she can in fact eat of the fruit, and again, we are learning a merit on her because she was tricked by none other than the primordial snake who was injected with the evil venom of the, I say without any doubts, with the evil venom of the Satan, that jealous angel who's been creating some trouble upon the earth for the last 5,773 years, that she, because of her elated status, her tremendous spiritual makeup, her tremendous physical makeup, because in the Talmudic literature she's considered to be one of the, even though the rabbis never saw her, from within the realm of Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, or the tradition taken down from Moses down to them, and then later written in the books of the Talmud, the writings, she was an extremely physically beautiful woman as well. But in her, whatever her efforts were. In fact, she had subjugated her husband as well as herself to now the ultimate judgment was that they would now be subject to a life which would be finite, as opposed to the original intent, according to the oral Torah traditions, was that man and woman and the rest of the human female experience was supposed to go into eternal mode from the very beginning. And the question is, why pick on the woman? But perhaps a deeper perception we want to humbly suggest is here we're not talking about because she was woman, which she dealt with severely, to be given the pain and anguish of pregnancy, and now her longing would be for her husband and the domination of him over her, but the fact that she, as one human being, had inflicted damage upon another human being, regardless of her intentions, as high as they might have been or as negative they might have been. You can take either side you want of this play of discussion, but so the fact that she had caused damage, and the fact that she was in the feminine form of the species, and that Adam was the masculine form, to me, is at some point, is irrelevant. And Rabbi Nachman even mentions this in his teachings in Brezov Chassidus. The ultimate consciousness of a human being is to go beyond the gender of the human being you're talking with and just talk to the human being, of course, who is configured to the divine image. Now, the anguish that she had, of course, with birth, from that point on, women would begin to menstruate until this day. The anguish of raising children, because her first two children, unfortunately, there was a homicide committed by one of her children against the other child, namely Cain killed Hevel, Cain killed Abel. And then she had other problems ensuing from the eventual birth of her other son, not necessarily because Chase was bad, but the problems that developed with the early stages of mankind, where people at a very early stage of the human of the human family experience were openly rebelling against God. And she, looking back as mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, because remember, so she lived hundreds and hundreds of years. She didn't live to 39 or even 120. Adam, I know, lived, he's documented, he lived 930 years. I don't know exactly the amount of years that Eve lived, but I'm trying to share with you not the definitive role, but ultimately we're not talking about it's a man-woman thing, and no man should ever use this verse. It's literally a profanation. It's of the Torah teaching. It's a direct act against God to oppress a woman because she's the female gender, because a man would want to justify what the Most High had decreed upon woman and future species or the future gender of all women throughout history. So I'm going to leave it at that, and I'm sure Dennis and Ron will have their own unique perceptions on this. And again, everyone, you gentlemen, you're free to speak your minds, heart and souls, and then we'll conclude the show. Dennis.
Yes, I'm a realist, Don. And to me, that's more important than being a feminist. When God created the Garden of Eden, he put two important players there of equal nature, of equal powers, of equal mind. They both had a mind that God gave them.
Mm-hmm.
To think one would be dominant over the other, well, that's reality. Men always think they're going to be over the women, and the women don't mind that because they know in the long run they got it all covered. Men sometimes think they're the boss, but that explanation to me always rang true when I heard it from a Christian viewpoint, and that is that the man is the head of the family, but the wife is the heart of the family. The heart and the mind have to work together because procreation depends on that. The survival of the species would not occur without the woman. So it's a balancing act that was stated from the beginning, but the reality is to unbalance it. The man would take control. Control of what? Without the woman, he's only taken control of half of the stuff. So
right.
We must be mindful that how these things were explained, how they're applied, and how we live our lives today doesn't depend on only women who are pretty. There's a lot of women around. Not all men are pretty. Not all women are pretty. But we're all humans. But we're divided by male and female. And we're destined to live together.
Amen. Ron, your take on these matters, the very deep matters? Ron? Ron, you're on the
hello,
line?
Hello? Yes, I'm here.
Yeah,
yes, I'm
what
here.
Is your take on these matters, on this verse?
Okay. First of all, I feel that the Creator is not just out to punish us whenever we do something wrong. According to what I've studied so far, is that when a created being does something against the will of the Creator for the benefit of creation, they create a blemish, a deficiency. And what is meant out to us in our eyes as a punishment, actually it's a rectification of that. So all the things that were actually meant out for Eve because of the blemish she caused in mankind is actually a, what they call it in the Hebrew, I think, a tikkun, a rectification of
right.
what her blemish caused. And that's it. My take on the punishment attitude that is, most people see whenever they read this part of scripture. Second of all, in terms of man and woman dominance, all men who dominate must remember that they also came from a woman. And without
right.
her, they would not have had the ability to begin with to be here, much less dominate. And for me, it has been always a guide in how to treat women in general. Is that I always remember that I have a mother. I came from a woman. And as a result, I've always basically use this as my way of mediating my desire to control or dominate as a male, because I think that's naturally part of our makeup, because we basically, for lack of a better word, conquered the world, the uninhabited world, and acquired the money and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
I would like to mention that from within the Hasidic world, there is a Rav who wrote two books. That one book was for men. His name is Rabbi Shalom Arush. And he wrote a book specifically for men and requested that women not read it. And then he wrote a book for women requesting men don't read it. And in it, he shared his 30-plus years, he's still around, thank God, of marriage counseling, how men should be subservient to God's wisdom that she has, that man should be subservient to God's wisdom that God in his mercies has given him a wife with all her good points and bad points. And the woman, in the book for the woman, he wrote that a woman also should, in the ways he explained it in the book, various stories, how the woman should be subservient to God's wisdom that she has been given a husband as whoever her husband is, despite the fact he has good points and bad points and points in the middle. So this discussion will end here, gentlemen, and bless those listening in, but it's just something to consider. Now, I just heard something the other day on the radio that within the feminist movement that there is actually a voice being expressed now by Mormon women that they don't mind having also a domestic lifestyle. Now, meaning they would like to work. That's, of course, they have the freedom to do so. But also they would like to have the enjoyments that one can have, being the homemaker or being the mother or being the mate or being the nurturer, whatever you want to say. And I think that's nice to see that someone told me over the weekend late last week that actually there was a feminist who in the 1960s was promoting the idea that it was an act of oppression for a woman to carry a baby in a womb, and the future for the emancipation of women, the baby should be carried outside of the womb after, I guess, the fetus had developed to a certain point. I mean, to me, that would be an act of barbarism, not only to the developing fetus, but for the woman, because for whatever reason, which are really beyond our understanding, why the Creator chose that the women, as Ram mentioned, as a matter of tikkun, rectification, should experience the uncomfortable feelings and actual emotional feelings and physical sensations of carrying a child full term, why to let her be, she would lose her privilege. I mean, thank God this never came through. I just couldn't, to me, that would be moving into the world of like a cyber, a virtual type of living, which is so disconnected to true human living, where, again, we lament that women have to suffer. And by the way, if the husband's hopefully a good husband, he's also lamenting with her and trying to do what he can do to reduce her pain. Maybe he can do research and talk to doctors. I know the raspberry tea is supposed to be very good for women in a state of pregnancy or even when they're in a menstrual cycle. So we're talking about ultimately this verse was a wake-up call for all human beings, not just women, but also for men, human beings, that we should realize that we were put into a certain situation because original human beings made a mistake, and we can hopefully learn from their mistakes. And anyone who thinks this is coming to justify the oppression of one of the two types of gender that we have among men and women are sadly mistaken. Dennis, Ron, closing remarks, then we're going to segue to some beautiful music.
Ever so quickly, what God has created, we honor. We believe in it. We don't believe that we know the reason as to why he created a male or a female. But that's that's not important. He did it. We accept it. That's life.
Ron?
When the Creator created man in his image, and of course we see that first he created Adam, and the whole concept of male is actually of a giving, and the female is almost of a receptive. And God here created man in the terms of he's showing us that he is a giver of kindness, and women are a recipient of that kindness. And when the two merge, we have this beautiful state of humanity, civilization that we have today. And anyone, you know, infringing upon that in any possible way is actually detouring from what the Creator originally had planned and still has planned for us.
Mm-hmm.
That's my thoughts on that.
Beautiful. Gentlemen, what I'd like to do now, I want to play a song by Blessed Brother David Dohm, who we've been so accustomed in the past to play his music. And this song is actually where David is very transparent. I would say even naked, in basically bringing us back to a state of sort of like his own sense of who he really is as a human being. And this song, I'm going to read how he describes the song. And this is the words which are coming off the song "It's Enough" by David Dohm, which you can, if you want to see it yourself, it has some beautiful graphics accompanying it. It's called "It's Enough" by David Dohm. He writes the following. This was published on April 8th of 2013. He writes as following: I was ill last year with a tumor on my spleen. I became very ill with fatigue. I couldn't walk far and had to go to bed to regain my dwindling energy. I think my illness was the result of years of negative thinking that I had worked very hard to combat. I worked on my emunah, my faith, but there was always an underlying depression hovering inside, and found a home in my spleen. Once I was diagnosed, I had to have surgery to remove the whole organ, and thank God, Baruch Hashem, I'm much better now. I wrote and performed and recorded this song after I was told of the results. I decided to wage a war against all the emotional crud I had hidden. In this song, I also share my feelings about people who superficially have good intentions and come to help, but seem to me to be more concerned about being a healer than actual healing. Heads up, when someone is suffering, the best thing you can do is listen to them. Tell them that you're praying for their full recovery and be around when they have need for answers. Until then, refrain from providing answers. It only makes things more complex when simplicity is the biggest healer in a state of emunah, in a state of faith. I like this song. I think it's one of my best. It's a paradox, dark and emotional blues with a deep but happy message. So hopefully we're going to leave you with a deep and happy message. Right now, blessed souls, to remind each and every one of you, you are truly good and you are truly beloved by the Most High because you were given a divine image to help you get off in skirmish, to help you get home. the sounds of David Dom, and hopefully in a way of a Havachat, one love, Gorilachat, one destiny, Kulana, Badarki Shalom, in a peaceful Darki Noam, in a pleasant way, Lahamshich, to continue Bezer Hashem with the help of the Most High. Blessed souls, please remember, you're very, very good. And now it's enough by David Dom. Take care, everyone.
Shalom.
Bye.
With your eloquence.